afternoon. This is the professor, Dr. Ron Daniels, president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century and distinguished lecturer emeritus from York College, City University of New York. Welcoming you to this April 5th, Easter Monday, day after the martyrdom of Dr. Martin Luther King edition of Vantage Point here on 99.5 FM. That's WBAI on the Pacifica Network in collaboration with YCRadio.org. What's coming shortly, we are hoping to speak to Bishop Reginald T. Jackson, who'll be talking to us about the voter suppression law in Georgia. He's in the eye of the storm. So we're going to be talking to him and giving his updates in terms of what that struggle looks like. But before we get into the specifics of it, as always, we want to encourage you to mask up. That's right, mask up and stay the course. I was listening to the reports from Danita Samuels of what's going on in Washington, D.C., gradually opening up, but maintaining discipline in terms of masking up, washing your hands, social distancing. And young people, beware. Beware. You are not immune. You're not invincible. This most recent variant, one coming out of England, is running wild, spreading wild up in Michigan and some other places around the country, and it is taking a toll on young people. And the other thing that's important to note is the long-term effects. If you get it, one of the things that doesn't get talked about enough is what they call the long-haul effects, shortness of breath, impact on your circulatory system. I mean, this COVID is no joke. So please, please stay the course. We're about to get there. And I'm delighted to say as of yesterday, my 2 weeks on my Johnson & Johnson vaccine. So I got my get out of jail card. But when I went out today, I had my mask on. I had my gloves on. I had my sanitizing wipes and everything. I'm acting like ain't nothing changed because I want to make sure that I am not spreading, sharing, and whatever. And then I just want to set an example. So we want you to do the same thing. Also, we know that there's still a tremendous amount of anxiety out there because of a variety of things that are just taking place in our society today. COVID is one of them, what to do, and some of the issues emerging, some of the reckless behavior of others and all of that, which is why we have a listening line. We have a listening line, Community Cares Listening Line, the Institute of the Black World 21st Century. And we've talked about this before. Culturally appropriate listeners are there to hear you out. There's a lot of increased suicide, domestic abuse, just watching the trial of a police officer shoving in Minnesota is enough to traumatize you. So we have culturally appropriate listeners. Call 877-827-6677. That's 877-827-6677. And it's confidential. It's anonymous. And we've gotten good response from people trusting the Institute of the Black World 21st Century's Black Family Summit Community Cares Listening Line. It is there with our folks tuned in to listen. On the soapbox later today, we're going to tackle immigration policy. We're going to make you the experts again to see what you would be doing about the crisis on the border and immigration policy in general. Also interested in and concerned about anti-Asian hate and violence and black attacks, frankly, on AAPI folks, and to understand what's going on with that. So be prepared at the end of at the bottom of the hour. The number to get, you know the number, 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. We'll have plenty of time for you to express your opinions here on Vantage Point. Now that we're delighted to welcome to our microphones here at WBAI, Bishop Reginald T. Jackson. He is the presiding prelate of the sixth Episcopal District of the African Methodist Episcopal Church. He's based in Atlanta, but no stranger to people in these parts, because for many, many years, he was a very active and engaged pastor in Newark, New Jersey. So we want to welcome Bishop Jackson. Welcome to Vantage Point.
Yes, how are you doing? Good to be with you.
Well, it's good to have you with us. And let me just, first of all, just thank you once again, because when I reached out to you to come to Newark a couple of years ago for our gentrification summit, you didn't hesitate. You came, and you people are still talking about it, and we're going to be continuing that work. So I just wanted to thank you again for that. Bishop, before we launch off into the particulars about the issue of the voter suppression bill and all of that, I'd just like our audience to know a little bit more about you in terms of, you know, your work. I mean, the AME Church, by the way, is often in the forefront of the struggle for change, and has been historically. So I'm just wondering, what is it that influenced you to become a social justice-oriented faith leader?
Well, the fact of the matter is, I came to Atlanta in 1976 to attend seminar. And coming to Atlanta really had a tremendous impact on my life. I had a chance to see some of the people that I used to see on television and that kind of thing. For example, Dr. Benjamin E. Mays, Hosea Williams, Daddy King, Andy Young, all of that crowd. And I saw the impact that the ministers had in terms of changing policy, improving the quality of life of people. And that just changed my entire mindset as related to ministry. And I just think ministers have a chance to make an impact. And I think we really ought to do it. In fact, Atlanta was the cradle of the civil rights movement. And it just has kept my mind since 1976.
Right, wonderful. Bishop, you said you came to Atlanta. Are you from New Jersey original? Tell us a little bit about where were you born?
No, in fact, I am a native of the state of Delaware, the state that we say in Delaware, the state that started a nation. The first state to ratify the United States Constitution. Dover, Delaware, where I was born, where I spent my life until I left in 1976 to go to seminary. And again, Delaware really played a large role in my life. Ministers, again, who were involved in civil rights matters and social justice matters. So I've been wonderfully blessed in that regard.
So when did you then, because I first met you and knew you from Newark. So when did you come to Newark?
I was assigned to Jersey City, New Jersey in 1979. Spent 2 years in New Jersey. And then in 1981, I was assigned to St. Matthew Church in Orange, New Jersey, right outside of Newark. And I spent 31 years at St. Matthew Church, and had a chance to get involved in a whole lot of things in Essex County and in the state of New Jersey, which is just, you know, and was really bad. When I came to Georgia, I promised myself that I was not going to get all involved like I did in New Jersey. And I have failed miserably.
Yeah, well, the Lord has a way of calling on you, and so you can't really, you can't help yourself. I have a story about that in terms of when I went off to graduate school. I was saying I was going to do the same thing. So now you are in Atlanta. I just wonder if you would share with our audience, because you were right there. What did it feel like being on the ground in Atlanta as black voters led the charge to elect Reverend Raphael Warnock and John Ostop to the Senate of the United States?
Well, you know, it was a great moment. And I'm very pleased, because I think Georgia really shocked the nation. During the presidential race, the feeling was that Donald Trump would win Georgia. Georgia was not considered a toss-up state for the longest time. But what happened, and what people really did not know, following the gubernatorial race in 2018, when the governor's office was really taken from Stacey Abrams again by voter suppression, beginning in 2018, we made an effort to reshape Georgia. Stacey Abrams and I are very close. In fact, the 6th District is a partner with Fair Fight Georgia. And what happened is the demographics of the state were also changing. For example, between 2016 and 2020, there were over 800,000 new voters in Georgia.
Wow.
Most of them people of color. So the demographics of the state changed. And in fact, that's really what's driving all of this voter hostility in Georgia. It's the fact that I think the Republicans in Georgia realize that demographics are changing. Ain't nothing they can do about who's moving in. What you have to do is try to find a way to make it more difficult for them to vote. And so during the presidential race, for example, the 6th District at AME Church, we put in place what we call Operation Voter Turnout. And our goal was to get 75% of blacks to vote early. And I'm pleased because I really think we exceeded the goal. I think more than 75% of blacks voted early. And on election night, when most people went to bed, Donald Trump was ahead in Georgia by about 360,000 votes. But that's because on election night, the first votes they counted were those who voted on election day.
Right.
But what happened was we had about 1.5 million people who voted by absentee ballot and who voted early. And so when those votes started to come in, that's when the tally started to change and Joe Biden went ahead.
Right.
And then the same thing in the Senate runoff, people projected that the black turnout would decline because they said blacks would not turn out twice. Well, the fact of the matter is, we proved them wrong. In fact, black turnout was greater than the white turnout in the runoff election, and that's why we elected the first black senator and the first Jewish senator from the state of Georgia.
Right, right. Well, would you share with our audience, we are hearing about it, but you're really, again, on the ground, and you got the pulse, and you see what's going on. So share with our audience, what's in this draconian voter suppression law that was signed by Governor Kemp in that infamous photo with a group of six white men against the backdrop of a plantation? What's in this bill?
Well, the fact of the matter is, the first thing that's important to understand is that this bill is based on a lie. The lie came from who I call our former liar-in-chief, who declared that the election was stolen from him and that there was fraud. And that's what this legislation is based on. Yet the fact of the matter is we had 3 recounts in Georgia. We had an audit in Georgia. After the 3 recounts and an audit, the totals didn't change. Donald Trump still lost Georgia. In addition to that, there was no evidence of fraud. And on top of that, they had about 20-some court cases in Georgia. All of them were thrown out because the judges, some of them Republican judges, said the cases had no merit nor any credible evidence. So let's be clear. This legislation is based on a lie. And what Republicans have said is that they've put out this legislation to ensure and assure the people that the election had credibility. But my response to that is, if you keep telling all the people that the election was stolen, then why do you think they don't have much confidence in the election? They are believing what you want them to believe. As far as the bill itself, let's look at some of the draconian things that are in this bill. If the Republicans had won this election, none of these bills would have been introduced. These bills were introduced because they lost. It was a Republican legislature which passed these bills. For example, let's go with absentee voting. Blacks turned out in huge numbers for absentee voting. Well, the law which they passed the other day changes absentee voting now so that the latest you can get your absentee ballot is 11 days before the election. That is a change, and it may seem minor, but it's really major, because that means if you do not get your absentee ballot by 11 days before the election, it won't count. But it also means that even if you have your absentee ballot and you take it in 9 days before the election, it can get to the voting office. But if it's in 9 days before the election, it will not count. Your absentee ballot must be in 11 days prior to the election. That, again, is a deliberate effort to make it harder for people who are of color and black voters.
Right.
In addition to that, with the absentee ballot now, you have to have a photo ID. Again, that negatively affects blacks because among Georgians, there are over 200,000 people who do not have a driver's license. Most of them are black. So they've got to find now another photo ID. So that's the first thing. Second thing, we have what we call ballot drop boxes. The ballot drop boxes used to be located outside. For example, I vote by absentee ballots. The ballot drop boxes used to be outside. So if somebody got off work at 8 o'clock at night, they could take their absentee ballot and drop it in the ballot drop box. They are secure, they are locked, they are monitored. Well, under this law, now the ballot drop box has to be put inside a building. And when that building is locked, for example, if that office closes at 5 o'clock, then that ballot drop box is closed. So if you get off work at 7 o'clock, you can't drop your ballot off in the ballot drop box. That's the first problem with it. But the second problem is they now claim the law says you have to have a ballot drop box in every county. Well, here's the problem. Georgia has 159 counties. And most of those counties, you're only allowed to have one drop box.
Wow.
For example, I live in Fulton County. Fulton County is the largest county in the state of Georgia. It's the largest geographically, and it's the largest numerically. There are over 800,000 voters in Fulton County. Well, the most Georgia can have is five drop boxes. This last election, Fulton County had 30-some drop boxes.
Wow.
They've now dropped 30-some down to five. Most blacks in the state of Georgia live in Fulton County. Then the most troubling thing about it is they passed a law that said the state election commission. And the problem is the state election commission is not evenly balanced. You don't have an equal number of Democrats and an equal number of Republicans. In Georgia, the state election commission is predominantly Republican. And if they decide under this law, they can come into any county in Georgia, dismiss the county election commission, and take over. For example, they would be able to check. If this law was in place last year, Donald Trump might very well have gotten what he wanted when he wanted them to change the election results. The commission could say, we don't like the results, we're going to change them. That's only partly why this bill is so horrible.
Now, is there a provision also about souls to the polls or Sunday voting?
Well, what they did, and it's interesting, originally the bill called for souls to the polls to be abolished. Well, there was so much of an outcry, so much fury. What they did was they took that out of the bill. But what they did instead was they now said it's up to the county. You can either have voting on Saturday, or you can have voting on Sunday. It's up to the county. Well, that means in southern Georgia and some of these counties, there's nowhere in the world they're going to go with Sunday voting. So they'll probably make it on Saturday. And let me also say this, what they did with the weekend voting. It used to be with the weekend voting, polls open from 7 to 7. On the weekend voting now, it's only open from 7 to 5.
Clearly, voter suppression. It's interesting, this morning I happened to be watching one of the channels, and the lieutenant governor came on, and I don't know, he seems to be trying to have it all on all sides. So he was trying to persuade folks that the bill is really not that bad, that it's really a good law, that things needed to be fixed. I don't know what he was attempting to do, but what's your opinion of the lieutenant governor?
Well, the fact of the matter is interesting. I met with Lieutenant Governor a number of times. In fact, the very day that the legislature passed this bill, I met with the Lieutenant Governor. Lieutenant Governor, which is interesting, I think lacks political backbone. The president of the Senate in Georgia is really a weak position because the president of the Senate in Georgia, Lieutenant Governor, really doesn't have a vote. Even in the Senate, it was a 50-50 tie. The lieutenant governor doesn't have a vote. But what the lieutenant governor could have done, now he says he was opposed to these bills and that he didn't think they should be considered. But what he could have done, he could have done so that there would not have been a vote in the Senate. But he didn't do that. What he did was he left the chamber and let the president pro tem preside. And I said to him, I said, Lieutenant Governor, why did you? He said, well, they knew why I left. Yeah, but why didn't you tell them? Why didn't you let the state know? You walking off. I said, people could have felt like you had to go to the restroom. And that's where it was.
Well, Bishop Jackson, you are in the at the forefront. And I'm loving it because I'm a strong proponent of this particular tactic and strategy. Mm-hmm. You are calling out corporations, well-known corporations, in a way that, frankly, Martin Luther King did in his final speech. He called out some corporations as well. But you're calling out Coca-Cola and Delta Airlines and Home Depot and saying that they need to speak up or they need to face boycott economic sanctions. So first of all, why did you adopt that tactic and how, and is it working?
Well, in fact, Coca-Cola and Delta have both come out with very strong statements against the bill. My only concern, and I said it to the president of Coca-Cola, problem is you all wait until the bill passed before you came out against it. So that's one problem. But number two, we are trying to arrange, in fact, a meeting either tomorrow or Wednesday morning with corporate executives across the country in terms of not only this bill in Georgia, but they have this legislation now in 47 states. And so we're trying to get them to come out publicly and openly against this legislation. If they do that, then in fact we will not go through with the boycott. If they don't do it, we will have no choice but to boycott, and we'll do it with mercy. We can't keep giving our dollar to support companies that aren't supporting us.
Right. Absolutely. Now, Major League Baseball, and there seems to be some debate about this, but the Major League Baseball made the decision that they were going to pull out the All-Star game, and they were also going to pull out the draft and the economic impact of that is somewhere in the range of about $100 million, we're told. So where do you stand on that that particular tactic? There's some people who are saying that maybe it'll hurt the black community. Some people are saying maybe this was not the right move, and others are saying otherwise. How do you stand on that issue?
Well, the fact of the matter is that the state's leaders, our main focus is on the corporate boycott because each individual decides whether or not they're going to participate in the boycott. At the same time, I am not opposed to what Major League Baseball did. I think Major League Baseball made a decision which reflects their values. And so I commend them on that. And I understand from some people that they feel like Major League Baseball moving to All-Star Game and other boycotts are going to hurt the black middle class and poor people. The fact of the matter is, if we do nothing, it's also going to hurt the black middle class and poor people, because elections have consequences.
Right, absolutely.
If you suppress the black vote and other folks get in who do not share your interest, they're not going to vote in what you believe is in your best interest. So you can't sit back and do nothing. You have to do something.
Right. Quickly, if you would give us a status report on the courageous representative, I think her name is Representative Shannon, who was knocking on that door as a duly elected official with some responsibilities, we're told, to monitor and to report back to her caucus and to and whatever. But she was sort of, I mean, drug out and arrested. How's she doing?
Yes, so Representative Park Cannon is doing fine. In fact, I admire her. You know, the governor is speaking out so boldly now, but he wanted to sign this bill in a locked room behind closed doors. And she knocked on the door because she's a state representative, and she felt like if the governor's going to sign this bill, he ought not do it behind closed doors. So I commend her for that. And when she knocked on the door, they arrested her, and she has a court date coming up. But she has a whole bunch of folks in the state of Georgia and, in fact, across the nation who are supporting her, and I don't believe they're going to be able to do anything to her.
Right, right. Well, shifting the subject as we conclude, Bishop Jackson, there was also one of these mass shootings, and there's been a series of them. I mean, there's a lot of just painful things happening in the country these days. And there were eight people who were killed, six were Asian American women. And the AAIP community has raised its voice and has asked for assistance, support, and help. But there has been some, we've seen some indications across the country of a couple of instances where black men, I think, have attacked Asian people. And there seems to be some hostility brewing in some areas. I wonder whether you would just give your perspective on this whole question of where we as black people should stand in relationship to violence against Asian Americans.
I am very saddened and disappointed about what's happening to Asian Americans. What's happening to Asian Americans cannot be separated from what happens to black Americans or brown Americans. Discrimination to discrimination, and I am very sad if any blacks are taking part in attacking and brutalizing Asian Americans. The fact of the matter is, this is some more result of the foolishness, and I mean the sheer foolishness, of Donald Trump. He blames completely the coronavirus pandemic on the Chinese. And so therefore, he has basically tried to give license to people attacking Asian Americans. I believe it is extremely unfortunate, just like we want our, the Asians and Latinos and everybody to support blacks in the midst of our struggle. They have every right to expect blacks to support them in the midst of their struggle. And I am opposed. I am vehemently opposed to anybody attacking any Asians, any Latinos. I just think what the scripture says, you do to other folk like you want them to do to you. And my thing is, if it's wrong for white folk to do it, it's wrong for black folk to do it, for brown folk to do it, for Asian people to do it. There's no right way to do wrong.
Right. Well, Bishop Jackson, we are so happy that you were took time out of your very, very busy schedule. We've been watching you all over the television screen, courageously standing up. And as you said before, you just can't get it out of your system. You went down to Atlanta and tried to just chill a little bit, but the Lord wouldn't let you do it. So you're still on the front lines, and we are all blessed for your advocacy, for your strength, for your courage and your vision. And we thank you so much. And we look forward to bringing you back again to give an update. And we'll be doing some other things with the Institute of the Black World, 21st Century World. We'll be calling upon you to be a part. So thank you so much.
Well, pray that I just get one boring day, and I'll be happy.
All right. Thank you so much. All right, to our listening audience, that you've listened to Bishop Reginald T. Jackson. Gave you a little bit about his life story and his background. I like to do that because sometimes you work with people, but you don't really know what their background is. He is the presiding prelate over the 6th Episcopal District for the African Methodist Episcopal Church based in Atlanta. He also served a term last year, or I think it must have been 2019. He was the overarching presiding bishop of all of the bishops. They rotated at the time that he came to Newark, New Jersey for the gentrification summit. Made a powerful presentation in the town hall meeting, and that town hall meeting can still be seen on the IBW website at ibw21.org, ibw21.org. But where he closed is where I want to segue to our listening audience. I want to get a sense from our listening audience if you call 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877, about why it is that we find and we see Black folk who are attacking Asian folk. And it seems just Black men. And we've seen a couple of very vicious attacks. And I've been involved in some conversations where I've picked up some anti-Asian sentiment. Somehow that's a feeling that, you know, they don't support us. Why should we support them? And that kind of thing. So I'm just interested in hearing from my listening audience, what your feelings are, what your sentiments are, what is behind that, and what it is that we might do about it. 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. We have open lines right now. We have a lot of time, a lot of space for people to call. I'd like to do about a minute each. We can't draw the conversations out too long, but we have plenty of time for our soapbox segment today. The other thing is immigration policy. And in some ways, these may be related. You know, how do you deal with the crisis on the border? What should be done? What are the solutions to that as you see it? You're the expert. What would you be doing about immigration policy to solve the crisis, you know, on the border? Again, you can call us right now. Your open lines at 212-209-2877. 212-209-2877 gets you instantly into the conversation. And we hope to get a number of callers and contributing your ideas. What is behind the Black attacks that you're seeing? And this may not be the majority, but even if it's a minority, one wonders what is behind these attacks. Is there some sentiment brewing, and is there some legitimacy to it or not legitimacy to it? What are your views coming from our audience here at WBAI 99.5 FM on the Pacifica Dial and on the Pacifica Network, again, in collaboration with YCRadio.org? And immigration, big issue. It's here. Going to have to deal with it. I understand that there were the unaccompanied minors. Last week, someone talked about the fact, well, these are not really children, but the terminology is unaccompanied minors. Some of them are teenagers. Some of them are babies. You saw literally people dropping babies over the border, dropping them over a wall out of desperation. What do we do about that? I don't know, they're saying 5,000 a day. I mean, and then the conditions are very difficult. But this is a part of a overall problem that needs to be addressed. How would you address it? How do we, as a nation, your policy expert, address these vital questions? 212-209-2877. Don't be bashful. Don't be shy. 212-209-2877. There's some who perhaps have not called or don't call often. This is your opportunity. That's why I have this soapbox segment, so that people can, in fact, call in and share their perspectives. Now, I do actually limit it to a certain number of folk because I don't want to, you know, just drift off any topic. All right, let's begin the conversation. Good afternoon. You're on Vantage Point.
Hello.
Good afternoon. You're on Vantage Point.
Good afternoon.
Yes, your opinion, please.
Okay, my situation on immigration is it's never going to change.
I'm not hearing you. Did we lose that caller?
No, he hung up.
Oh, okay. All right, let's go to our, and others can call at 212-209-2877. You know, this is free space. Express your opinion. Let's get your ideas. In some ways, it's good to get the ideas out so we know what's there so we can talk about it. Good afternoon. You're on Vantage Point.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me on. I appreciated the segment just before about voting rights in Georgia. It's very disturbing, and I know and your guest had a good rundown of what happened to that state representative, and that enough attention is paid, and it was so outrageous that nothing's going to happen to her, we think, but it's disturbing as hell that they didn't need to do that. They didn't need to arrest her and then charge her with all those. She could have done real time there. Well, that's what they were trying to do, was silence, you know, any kind of dissent. But what I do want to say about the anti-Asian attacks, the violence, as a white man who is living in the city and is taking, culture in and seeing what happened last year, people need to be on the move again like we were last year, because when the movement is happening, you don't. You know, and not to say that it doesn't happen, but energies are focused in a productive way and not in a, trying to taste from what I think is the pool of white supremacy, that you don't need to be white to kind of imbibe, if you know what I mean. I think that Trump amplified what was already happening, obviously. That's nothing new. But I think that kind of racism, whether it's against Asian Americans, whether it's against Black Americans, anybody, is a product of white supremacy, and that needs to be, watching the Fred Hampton movie and thinking about that, we need another rainbow coalition. We need to abolish everything about this society that keeps people divided, and also make space for real mental health and real care. Save that, it's going to be more, just kind of band-aids and PR and nice sentiments and stuff, but it's not going to really make people feel safe. That's how I feel. We need to come together and be out in the streets and in a movement,
right,
and taking those people under our wings collectively who are in pain, who are lashing out. You know what I mean?
Okay. All right. Appreciate your sentiment. Obviously, I'm a former executive director of the National Rainbow Coalition under the Reverend Jesse Lewis Jackson, who popularized the idea of a Rainbow Coalition and actually went forward to try to implement it. And I am proud to have played a role in that. And I agree, we do need, from my perspective, critics notwithstanding, I think we do need a Rainbow Coalition. 212-209-2877. 212-209-2877. Let's go to our next caller. Good afternoon. You're on Vantage Point.
Hello. I'm calling regarding black men attacking Asians.
Yes.
I think a lot of that, some are homeless, some are misfits, and some have mental problems. But I think some of them are thugs, hoodlums, who's been attacking us, the black population, for years. And they're using this as an opportunity to attack what they feel that's easy target because of so much of the sentiment, going against them from certain quarters. So I think a lot of these thugs and hoodlums that has been attacking us, black people, for years, and they're just using it that way.
Mm. Interesting perspective. I appreciate you hearing that. It's almost as if you're saying, in effect, if they're attacking Asians, it gets more attention than if they're attacking blacks. It's sort of the internal question of quote-unquote black-on-black crime.
Yeah, well, I think it's the same type of people that's been causing us black people in our communities problems for decades, and now they're taking this as an opportunity. And you notice most of them are bullies, you know, and they're thuggish. They're thugs and hoodlums. And you got a few who are homeless and a few are mental problems.
Right, right.
I think it's thugs that's doing a lot of this.
Right.
And because the sentiment is going against Asians from so many quarters.
Right. Okay, appreciate your call and your perspective. Others can call at 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. What's behind black attacks on Asian Americans? We particularly have seen black men involved, particularly, but also immigration policy. How do we deal with the challenges on the border with unaccompanied minors coming across? Actually, there are significant numbers of adults who are coming, who are being turned back, because actually, people by international law seeking asylum, we are duty bound as a country to accept and process their claims. The unaccompanied minor issue is an entirely different one. People are saying, you know, take my child, and in many instances, there may be a relative here and all of that, but it's the size of the wave that's coming. President Biden is taking heat because people are saying that he has opened the door, that he's welcoming folks. And, of course, the Republicans are hitting him very hard, saying that by him saying, quote unquote, he would have a more humane policy, that this has been an invitation for people to say this is the right time. There's also coyotes and cartels are all involved in this as well. Very complicated issue. 212-209-2877 gets you in. Let's go to our next caller. Good afternoon. You're on Vantage Point.
Hi.
How are you this afternoon?
Good, good. Always a great program. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
For me, by any division necessary, it is always it. Asian people have to also, to me, look at how about when our elderly is attacked. Spanish women were attacked, and you know, they put their little purse in their bra sometimes, because my grandmother used to do that, and she got ripped off. And you wouldn't see it on the air every single day. And I'm not trying to compare pains, but it just seems that, yes, they are getting more attention. And please don't say black attack. Please don't say that. Certain men who have happened to be black. Because you know what? We're not the ones shooting them up with machine guns. And, you know, it's disgusting that you pick on elderly, period, you know. But I am concerned because a lot of times Asian people would align themselves with white people. I have experienced, and I have seen it, where I go somewhere and get serviced by an Asian person and they talk behind the back of the black person and they tell me, a Latina, they say, oh, black people are bad. I have experienced that. Their racism towards and the way they service us, they come to our neighborhoods and have their restaurants, and then they don't serve us with that. You know, our money is as green as anybody else. So I'm not saying that it's, you know, it's right, because it's not. But it goes deeper. That's why I'm saying I started off with by any division. You know, is necessary for the day, you know. So,
I'm actually glad that you brought this up because I'm listening, but I think
I have always felt that they, you know, even when they make a mistake, it's like they're very impatient. And, you know, I've seen it with my eyes, you know, young men get treated like garbage and they were black, you know. So I think they need to reflect too that. Maybe it's a lot of built-up frustration on all angles. You know, we're dealing with a lot now, you know.
So, right. Well, thank you much. Really appreciate you. appreciate you bringing up that, you know, offering your perspective on this. Because I think this gets at it. I recall back in the days of Mayor David Dinkins, my God rest his soul, the whole Korean, the boycott against the Korean store, because there people talked about how people were being treated in these stores. And I think this is real, and quite frankly, in the black community, it's for generations, if it's one group or another, and to be honest about it, I'm not so sure how well some of our own people treat each other in some of these stores as well. But certainly it became a source of tension. And I think that's what's driving some of this, the feeling that we speak up for others, but others don't speak up for us. I would ask our audience, though, when you see whether it was Eric Garner, whether it was any of these different black folks who have been killed, if you look in those audiences, you see progressive, forward-thinking, and in some ways, I say that deliberately, because in every community we have people who have different perspectives and function differently. You find large numbers of Asian American activists in those demonstrations. When I was at the Center for Constitutional Rights, for example, you know, around police brutality and misconduct, one of the key groups involved in was the Committee Against Anti-Asian Violence was arm in arm with the Malcolm X grassroots movement and whatever. So it is layered. And I think we have to take that into account. And I was in a conversation the other day and people thought, well, you know, the Asians vote Republican. Not really. And the coalitions, the Rainbow Coalition that was being referenced before, if you look at President Obama, Biden, whatever, you see a very large percentage of AAIP people who are really voting on, for lack of a better term, the progressive side. So I just wanted to throw that into the mix. Let's go continue with our conversation. We got a few more minutes. Actually, we got to get time to get a few more callers in. Good afternoon. You're on Vantage Point.
Hello.
Good afternoon. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah. Good afternoon. Interesting topic. I wanted to touch on both. I've had the good fortune to live on both coasts. And I'll start with the Asian issue. For various reasons, lifestyle, preference and such, I've had the opportunity, shall we say, to be quite involved in the Asian communities, both here and in California. And the manifestation of that culture is much different over there than here. In California, there many more types of Asian cultures out there, and they act differently. To the point of Asians being white, I actually asked an Asian friend this, and they responded to me in this way. They said, you know, when you're coming from outside of the country, your perspective is the one that you're shown. And what it is that you see outside is what is shown as being correct. And we all know what that image is. It's not, as this person said, it's not that we want to be white. That's the image that we're given, which I thought was a very interesting view on things. The other issue, which I think you touched upon, is that the Asian community, like any other community, is very diverse. You've got Koreans, you got the Japanese, you got the Chinese from the south, the Chinese from the north, the Thais. You know, it's not a monolith. And as I said, having the opportunity to have been exposed to that culture for decades, I've learned a lot. And maybe there's a few more things that they need to learn about us. The second issue with regard to the immigration is, as I remember, I'm sure you remember Hugh Hamilton, and he had an interesting saying. He said, a lot of people are here because the United States is there. And I'll give you a touching example. I worked in a clinic in Los Angeles years ago, and there were two young men who fled El Salvador And I'm sure you remember back in the 90s, the horrific stuff that was going on down there.
Oh, yes.
The killing and all the rest of that stuff. And they were here because people were cutting, shooting up, hanging, whatever, down there. So if we weren't doing some of the stuff that we are doing up here, maybe they wouldn't be running so fast to the border.
Right. That is a major, major point that people need to see. And sometimes, again, on the ground, as you're bumping up against people and they're pitting us against each other, sometimes it's hard to see that lens. But the reality is, I talk about the development and the same development, underdevelopment paradigm that Walter Rodney talked about in his iconic book. The United States of America, you know, has been all over, you know, Latin America, supporting dictators, exploiting folks, and really underdeveloping these economies. And in a real sense, that is a part of what's driving much of this. And in a way, the way to deal with it is to have a different kind of posture, a different kind of attitude. So I think you've struck on something very, very important to look at as we think about, you know, how we resolve this. Look, appreciate your call so much. Mm-hmm. We got time to squeeze in maybe one more as we get ready to take our next call. Let me also suggest that H.R. 40, the bill that is going to create a commission to study and develop reparations proposals for African Americans, not just to study it. This is on the verge of passing. The most recent hearing conducted by Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee, the Japanese American community sent in over 300 letters. Over 300 letters were submitted to the record, and they were enthusiastically, you know, supporting the idea of reparations for African Americans. Let's go to our listening audience for our final caller. Good afternoon. You're on Vantage Point.
Good afternoon, Professor Daniels. How are you?
I'm doing fine.
Okay.
Could you speak up a little bit?
Yes, I'm speaking loud.
Okay.
I'm Jocelyn, and I'm from Whitehamwood, IT. We know each other. We've worked together. This country has been suffering from a disease that is not COVID. It's called organic stupidity disorder. This is my other name for racism. And nobody is exempt from that disease. And unfortunately, there's no medication for it. Everybody has been victimized by racism and dividing to conquer. This empire has a PhD in it. So, and there's also the ignorance that some Americans, fortunately not all Americans, are suffering from organic stupidity disorder, but the ones that are suffering from it, they don't care about geography because the world is supposed to revolve around the U.S. and they don't know where they are in New York compared to New Jersey. So that means everybody who has a certain phenotype is the same thing. Everybody's Chinese, whether you are Korean or you are Japanese, you're Chinese. Okay, so that is one of the problems that America is suffering for. The pathology is very deep. And the people who are rich make sure that they divide everybody. And some people who have a little less melanin, when they come here, they try to merge inside the white superiority baloney. And
right.
That's what caused all these problems. And,
right.
As the gentleman before said, the U.S., an empire right. has 800-plus bases. Come on.
Right. Well, you're hitting on a point I'd like to explore more, but we're up against a hard out. So we'll continue to talk about this because this is not going away, and we want to continue to talk about it. Thanks so much for your call. Yes, we appreciate the show today and your listening and chiming in. Don't forget the cultural, the appropriate listening line that you can call. And again, we'll be continue to talk about this in future shows. This is the Professor Dr. Ron Daniels. We'll see you again next week here on Vantage Point. Stay tuned for the WPFW and WBAI news coming up right now.